This is the fourth in the Summer Digital Cluster seminars. We're here today to listen to Alejandro Giacometti and Alberto Campagnolo from UCL and the University of the Arts, respectively, who are both PhD students and are going to be talking about cultural heritage instruction, in particular documenting parchment degradation by multispectral imaging. And I'll leave Alejandro and Alberto to tell us everything about that.
So documenting parchment degradation via multispectral imaging. This is first of all, I'd like to thank my collaborators. This is a very multidisciplinary project. Two of them are here. Alberto Campagnolo is the best conservator in the world, and Lindy McGowan is the boss of the measure. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about multispectral imaging, what it is, and then I will show you how we are using multispectral imaging to document the degradation of a manuscript with parchment, how it affects readability, and how we're using spectral imaging to recover that writing, and in combination with image processing. So, yeah. What is multispectral imaging? We can divide, like we usually divide light into visible light and there is outside the visible light. To longer wavelength than we can see are infrared, usually, for example, what cooks your food when you put your oven in the air, it's infrared light. And in shorter wavelengths, it's ultraviolet light. And that is what passes your skin in the sun. And we call visible light visible because humans can see it. So because we've designed cameras can see visible light as well. But other animals, dogs, they do not see the same technology. This is human visible light. And so the way that you make a color image is by taking a range of that visible light, usually from 400 to 500, and integrate that into a blue image. You take a range from the middle ground, and integrate a green image, and you take a range from the upper section, and you make a red image. And you put those images together, and you have the illusion of a color image. And I say illusion because the image is not recreating the whole spectrum of visual light. It's just putting light in specific wavelengths, which trick your eye into thinking that the whole spectrum is being reproduced. And so what multispectral imaging is dividing the visible spectrum and sometimes some of the infrared into the infrared into shorter sections. We have done it with around 20 sections of 20 nanometers width, and integrating an image only in that section. And we do that using filters that block everything outside the spectrum into and just a very small part of the light spectrum. And what this allows us to do is track the reaction, the reaction between physical materials and light. So for example, if you have a document with maybe parchment and some sort of writing, and you would take a picture with it, or you would see it just on a paper, you would see light parchment and dark, and that's all the total information that you have. With the spectral imaging, what you have is you can track that the light parchment is mostly like it's light, but it's lighter in some areas of the visual spectrum. So it might be lighter on the blues and get a little bit darker on the red, and then and then it goes really, really light on the infrared, and the red and the infrared. And the same with ink. You see that it's mostly dark for the visual spectrum, but maybe it's very, very light in the infrared spectrum. So light that it's invisible. If you have a document that is composed of more than that, which you usually do, you have, let's say, some parchment and some noise, some mold, and maybe two different kinds of inks. What this allows you to do is see, for example, with the two inks, throughout the visible spectrum, they might look exactly the same. But into the infrared, you see that one of the inks becomes very light and the other one doesn't. And so with multispectral imaging and some analysis of the data, we can pick them apart, which is really good. Multispectral imaging has been used exactly for this in cultural heritage. Perhaps the high profile project is the Achilles Palette, which they've used multispectral imaging to take a document that has been scraped off. So a palimpsest is a document that has been written once and then scraped off and another project partially they use. And with the use of multispectral imaging, we can separate from the writing, the original Archimedes writing from the more modern gate. So at the beginning of my PhD, what I concentrated was when multispectral imaging is used in cultural heritage projects, basically you have one interesting document that you want to be able to make, and you make it, you image it, and then you run it through a variety of different image processing techniques in order for you to visually see more of the writing. But there is not much testing on how much of that writing I'm able to recover. So what I did was I created a computer model of two kinds of text with stains and texture of a document, and I simulated multispectral imaging, and I processed those multispectral images into analysis to try to recover the original text, and I was able to get a quantifiable number, a measure of how much of that original text are we recovered. But of course, this is a computer model, so it's a simplification of what happens in reality. So what we've done, and what we'll come to talk to you today, is this project of taking a real document and trying to accomplish something similar, to test how much information can we recover from a document that has been damaged. And so what we've done is we have this document that's dated 1753. It's a deaccession manuscript from the London Metropolitan Archive. So already damaged real cultural heritage. And we've cut it into 23 squares of 8 centimeters each. All of these samples have just parchment and one type of ink. Some of them might have other elements, but we've tried to standardize more. And there are two of them that have text open writing in both sides. And we used 21 different filters. 16 of them across the visible light spectrum and 5 of them into the infrared. They let through about 20 nanometers of light with regular intervals across the light spectrum, and the infrared ones are around the nanometers. Then we've used two different imaging different two cameras. One of them is a color camera, which has the advantage that it has a much higher resolution, but it cannot see much into the infrared spectrum. And we have a monochromatic camera, so it's not a white picture, but it can see from the visible into way into the infrared. We've also used two different illumination modalities. We have light reflecting off the bystander prototype. Degree angle that you see here, and we have another light table which shines light through the department and into the camera. At the end of the project, we're going to have about 3,000 images, and including some calibration. The calibration images are important because they tell us not about the samples, but about the system as a whole and how to use it, which is why that is important. So I'll give you some examples. This is piece number 509. It's a single sided piece, and it has been demonstrated with the 16 visible light filters. And you can see that the camera is not very sensitive, very close to the ultraviolet, the first image there, or close to the interval. So it's mostly sensitive. But you can track the variation across spectrum. And this is an example of double sided transportation to both sides of the text because they have illuminated them from behind. And the same, the camera is not very sensitive and very low to the This on the other hand is the sample has been used with the full range of data. So you can see that the first 16 are similar to the ones we saw before, but you can also see the inferred ones. And it's interesting to see because you can see that the ink becomes very, very light in the inferred. So it becomes almost not the full white image that we see there. There is close calibration in the but they could track how illumination distributes on top of the sample. So we cannot assume that all of the light is regularly sampled, but we have to check. In order to make assumptions about the data, we have to regularly show you how to do that. In every sample, we got a small circle of 1 millimeter, as before, in order for us to be able to track. And this image will show you the resolution of the two the color image is much more chromatic and that's more certain so and that's what we are thinking about how are we treating this
So I'm guessing that most of you will be familiar with what happened but in case It is so it is made mostly of protein collagen plus a few other substances like elastin, rubber proteins, and fat. And the way in which the collagen is structured within the skin is in a very hierarchical way. So you start from the molecules that arrange themselves in a stratohelix kind of a structure. And then these helix come together to form what is known as fibers, and more fibers come together to form a fiber. And between all of the molecules and the various levels of hierarchy, you have molecular and chemical bonds between the parts. So you have cross links and hydrogen bonds. And when parts degrade, these links that are broken by the substances that coming to contact with the function. So how do you go from this to this? You start off with the animal skin, either fresh in butcher or preserved in salt, and then you soak them in water to clean out most of the dirt from the hair and the blood, and also to start swelling up the fibers inside the skin. Then the skins are placed into a bath with calcium hydroxide, and this process is called liming. And what this does is that all the external substances that are on the skin, like the fat, are burned away, eaten away by the lime. And traditionally, you will have a series of different baths with different concentrations of calcium hydroxide, and the skins will be placed in each of the baths for a given amount of time, and usually this time changes between the winter and summer to accommodate for different temperatures. Once the skin has been taken to the lime solution, it can be taken out and it can be dehaired. And because the liming has went into the skin and corroded away all the external materials, the hair is scraped off quite easily. And after that, the skin is put on a wooden frame and stretched. And now you can start scraping away what's left over of the external material, to some degree. It's normally done with a particular kind of knife. It's made in the shape of a half moon, and that's why in Latin it's called known as the lonello. and you can scrape away. And as you scrape away, you take away the cell material, like plasma door, and you thin down the skin, and also you start rearranging the structure of the collagen within the skin. After that, the skin is left to dry, and it dries on the frame, so it dries on the tension, and that locks the new structure of the collagen fibers into this new assembly. And then when it's dry, you can cut it off the frame and use it. Now I showed you some pictures of modern parts making, but we do have some historical evidence from the manuscript, and these are two miniatures from the 12th and the 13th century, and you can clearly see the wooden frame, the skin, and the lunello being used to produce the parchment. So once the skin has gone through the whole process, you end up with a material that is fairly durable. It will last for 100 years if it's kept in the right condition. It's fairly stiff. It's opaque because as it dries, air is trapped within the fibers, and it's highly hygroscopic, that is, it will react very, very readily to change in humidity. Parchment and leather both are products made from animal skin, but they are quite different in the fact that in leather you have the skin is chemically altered, and that makes it more difficult for the leather to rot away. Whereas in parchment, you don't have any chemical alteration, but it's the physical reorganization of the structure of the collagen fibers that actually makes it durable. And this is an important point to remember. Our document is written in what is known as Ironwool ink. This ink was used widely from the late antiquity up to the 19th and 20th century, and it was quite easily made because you didn't need a lot of material. To start off with tannin, taken normally from gold. Galls are this kind of growth that you will find on trees as an immune reaction to insect larvae placed on the leaves or the branches of the tree. You extract garlic and galantamic acid from the galls. You mix the solution with vitriol, and then you add gamaramic and water, and you end up with your ink. The ink will have eventually a nice deep coloration as you need it, and it's waterproof and lifelong. Now, if you actually were to make your own Ironwool ink, you will notice that at the beginning, your solution doesn't look much like an ink. And this is because the chemical reaction actually happens in two different stages. On the first stage, you have your tannin and the iron sulfate that react together to form a ferrous tannate complex. And this complex is soluble and can permeate deeply inside the fibers of the writing medium. Then, on the second stage, the ferrous tannate, as it dries, will react with the oxygen, forming ferric tannate pigments. And this is the coloration of your ink, the dark brownish color, and it's non water soluble, and that's why waterproof is what a light path, I would say. So how does parchment deteriorate? As you remember at the beginning, I showed you the different links that come together to keep the collagen structure together. You have different processes actually act on these chemical bonds and break them. And this could happen by oxidation, by heat, light, or the introduction of pollution, or by hydrolysis, which is where your chemical molecules are broken down into smaller molecules, and all of these eventually will start forming start the process of deoxygenation, which is by process by which your collagen molecules organized, reorganized in structured triple helix will start to unravel in a very chaotic arrangement. This changes the mechanical properties of your of the material, and you end up with a very fragile partial document. It's actually not even a major college anymore. When a document is kept into the internet collection in its own life, it can include different way of degradation. We have identified four main categories. So you have your mechanical damage, which is where the material is actually altered physically. Or you could have the material reacting to changes in humidity, temperature, or by when it's attacked by chemicals. And this normally happens mostly on the microscopic level. It could be attacked by a microorganism or insects or rodents. The text on your document would be obscured by the presence of other substances that make it impossible to read the text. And all of these kind of damages could happen at any stage of life of the document, starting from the production. So you could have technological mistakes in the production of the parchment or the ink or the binding, which is the bound document. If it's not stored properly, you can have problems due to the humidity or the UV light on the document, or natural disasters like fire or water coming into on the document. You could also have problems during the use of the document, either on purpose, like for punishment. When you reuse the parchment, or because of the handling, or after the happen, or sometimes even observation. If nothing like this happens to the document, still, because it's a natural component, it will eventually deteriorate by natural aging. So these are the samples that we have selected. We have our 23 samples here. Three are three controls that we have set apart. One from the inner leaf, one from the outer one, and one with a four running across it. And then we have a series of treatments that we have made on the samples, to try to mimic as much as possible a variety of damage that would happen to the document, from its storage, so like heat and light or mold growing on it, by applying some external substances on the document to obscure the text, either from some kind of dental substances, or by adding some other kind of inks on top of the writing. We have a series of mechanical damage. The scraping will try to mimic the process of making alistair. And then we have a series of chemicals that we apply on the sample between a strong acid, strong alkaline, and neutral water. All of these have been historically used on parchment. Sulfuric acid was used sometimes in the 19th century to speed up the lining process, and parchment made in this manner doesn't age as well. Hydrochloric acid was sometimes used in the production of aerosol ink, ended up with a very, very acidic ink that can corrode and eat in your document. Calcium hydroxide, of course, was used in the lining process. And sodium hypochlorite was sometimes used in conservation treatment to bleach parchment, and it had a very, very strong effect on the structure of the collagen. So if we go back to our first table, and we plot our damage solution on the table, we see that we try to cover as much as possible of the different kinds of categories of damage that can affect the document, and the different kind of reasons that can affect the document. And now we have just a couple of pictures of showing the process. This is the sample that is being baked in the oven for time in order to mimic the effect of heat. And you can see this is the result. Each one of these squares is 1 centimeter, and you can see that it shrunk quite a lot, because it's from 8 centimeters within just over 5 by 5. This is some one that we place under UV light, the UV light. We have some more drawing on one sample, human blood. Oil, the oil sample we chose in purple one is written on both sides, and it shows how the oil will go inside the structure of the fashion and push out of the air that was stuck inside and make it translucent with both sides of the rising. Wine, breaking away. This is the sodium hydrochloride and the aniline blood.
So we have our original function. We have cut it within the pieces, and we've imaged each one of these samples with a series of wavelengths and different cameras and two imaging modalities, and we have treated each one of these samples with different kinds of radiation methods, and we are in the process right now of imaging the second set of those samples, so imaging them after they have been degraded. I want to tell you a little bit about what are the issues that happen in this kind of process. How do we take all of these images that we have and turn them into actual information about the physical characteristics of the samples, which are useful then to understand. So one of the first things I showed you was those white images taken along each one of the samples, and each one of those 3D plots on the side basically represented these white images from the left perspective, and they're plotted so that height actually corresponds to the intensity of each one of the images. As you can see, They're not flat, but this is a problem, because if illumination is not flat across the surface, then the illumination is going to, the pixel values are going to vary across the space. And so each pixel, we cannot trust that each pixel value represents the relationship between the material and light, but also having depth as well. So we have to correct it. Another problem is noise. Noise are external events, things that happen in the system that we don't account for, and they affect the data in some way. And so the data moves away from representing the physical characteristics to something that we don't understand. So we have to keep a lot of this information from our experiment so that we can actually trust the data that we know. And perhaps one of the biggest problems is registration. So in here, this is an analysis called PCA, and I'm not going to go into too much detail about what it means, but the three images on the left show the variability in different dimensions of the data. And the first one is quite nice, because it shows you that we have a plain material in the background with another darker material, which is the red. But the second and third, they have this 3D effect, and what that means is that because the process of taking the images is manual, we put each filter on the camera and take it away. Slight movements in the camera make each picture be displaced. So what this is showing me is that there is vertical variation across the image, horizontal variation. So one of the first things we did is correct it. So because we want to see variation across the image, that's what we're doing. Variation in different ways or different materials. If we correct for this spatial variation, then we will actually get the variation of the image. So now I'm going to show you some of the examples of the images of the treated sample. This sample on the left here is 605, and it was the sample treated with sodium hydrochloride. You can see that the top half is not treated, but the bottom is, and the text is. So we're going to try to recover this. The second image in the current dimension that Alberto showed before. And as you said, it has now not only shrunk in size, but shifted slightly to the left. And so this is a problem, because how are we going to compare this image to this image of a tree, for example, that has been damaged to the original image? It's not good enough to be on top of each other. We have to have a consistent debris of the image. But our original idea was like, we have a document, we have a document that is composed of different materials. Can we take them apart? And this year, once we corrected for the variation in space, we can see that the first image shows us the variation in the first dimension, but the third one shows us that there is a difference between that smaller system one with the original image. And this is actually the case, because that is a pencil mark with the name that we need to keep track of the physical sample, and the other one is the iron mark. So we can take them apart, and that's really very nice initial result for that as well. Now, can we recover text of something like this? The sample, this is the same sample from the figure 5, which was treated with anything like the painted or whatever. And if you see the sample today, it is covered, half of it is covered with black background, and you cannot see anything. And then this is how it is. Before we did this. And we were able to track the variation across light, and we almost recovered completely the writing. And the reason we were able to do that is because even though these are three images that show the same sample of the other different ways, 520 and 660 nanometers are still inside of the visible spectrum. So if you see the sample, you cannot see anything. But at 750, slightly into the infrared, the ink, which turns transparent into the infrared, but this is early enough in the infrared that it still has some contrast with the parchment, can be seen. However, the anion light has turned transparent. So we were able to. In none of these images provide enough contrast to be read or singular, but the addition of all of them and the combination of all of them as a whole allow to give us enough information to be able to read. So, what do we want from this project? We have information about how the parchment and the writing is affected by different degradation. We were also able to recover some of the writing from the scripted samples that are not readable in actual light or with regular pictures. But what we also want to do is compare those recovered text to the original images and get a quantifiable way, a quantity of evaluating the methods of recovery. So, can we tell how much of the original we have recovered in an objective way? And of course, we know that we are able to perform a series of analysis methods. But one of the, I think, important outcomes of this project is that all of this data is going to be released in Creative Commons, including not only the images before and after, but also the calibration images and the methods that we use to analyze them.
And the details of all of the future. Thank you. Great, thank you very much. I have one or two questions, so I'll take them from later. But are there any questions?
Are there any specifications of the kind of illumination that you provided?
We're using tungsten lamps because they're a continuous spectrum, so we have that part of the radiation spectrum, and there's lots of power in the infrared, so we can get a good response from the docking at every way that one fills.
Thank you.
The white images show how the illumination varies. So we have the function light. So we reflect the illumination, we have a light table. So we have all that information.
Now in this case, your object might cause me if these are quite small. So in the larger, they're not able to cut any one, but in some cases, you cut one might have a larger. How do you control the illumination practice and the similar model of the project?
So the white images, when you're going to take a picture of a person, you first take an image of a white page of the same area of the document that you want to touch. And that white image is a map of how the light works. So when you take a picture of the document itself, you can use that white image to correct for any difference in the representation.
On the copy stand that we're using, we have four sets of lights. So we've tried to arrange them very carefully with geometry so that the illumination is relatively uniform across the area of touch. Pieces are only that size, so that small table is just and of course, it can never be perfectly uniform, there will always be some variation. And like Andrew said, you then have to use finished processing and look at what calibration is.
I think that's before you make more about the registration. Pretty much the same, I think, because of the people's flag, if it's the right chance.
So, I've actually we have two problems with illustration. One of them is when a single stack of images is taken, because of the, as I said, we change the filters manually, the camera shifts just slightly. And what I found is that those images are usually linearly displayed. So it is heavy processing, but it's a simple registration. There is some nonlinear variation, but it's very small. So we have found that ignoring it is dangerous. But then we have once we have the images with the untreated and the treated ones, that is a much more complicated problem. Because I work out of the medical physics department in UCL, I've been able to access some excellent mathematicians and there is a method that we're using which I can explain you more in the second. It's a non-linear registration of the and the software is available in the public, so if you need it, send it in.
You can get your calculation large.
So
if this is on the smaller sections, I'm assuming you're too good.
So this, I think the software is designed to register images of brain scan, and so they're quite large. So I don't know.
I think we saw that the issue of two cameras, so you put that in the right to have two cameras on the first advantage board.
Sure. So the regular cameras we have filters in the center which blocks any infrared light from the platform. So what we have is an RGB camera. Color camera can see only the distal surface. But these cameras have very, very high resolution. And so the reason we wrote is that we wanted high resolution images of the sample, but we also wanted to see some of the infrared. As you've seen, they have been quite useful. sort of monochromatic camera. It actually has no blocking, so it can see throughout the visual spectrum and also the infrared, although its resolution is.
Would you possibly use the map of most of our vehicles and perhaps invite them from the time of day? Like, if I understand correctly, you can for that range that you can do on the light table. So, if you use behind 10 or 10 days, you can use the box. But, if you have a book and you're not able to deliver it, remember it.
You could actually have, there are some light sheets or codes, so I'm not going to use in conservation, but that's quite bright, and there are like pages with the fiber optic running through them. So you know, you could do it on the book as well.
Yeah, no,
we're not
learning any studies about them and the one or the other.
Again, working
or your lab drawings?
No, no, working from the medical to that point. It was lots of part of study from our own there.
So you didn't
have
a cut yourself?
No, I didn't.
slightly more serious question, probably not much more. Is about the manuscript that you used. Said it's the museum section, so don't worry, it's not beyond cultural heritage. I sort of make him pause for a moment, because I mean, it is still some kind of cultural heritage, but we decided it's less important as the for it to survive than the value of what you're doing. But, I'm not sure what the question there.
In the archives, often if something is not deemed as that important, you can't put the medical. So some stuff is put aside. And that particular document was actually given to conservation for people to do some treatment on it to try on the old parchments before actually going on the something more viable. Because you can't really use modern parchment to do some trials because it's completely different the way actually yeah. So yeah, that way it was that's why it was the assessment. Also because it's only one part of the concept of a property, so the North London and the cornerstone it doesn't have a lot of value for the property.
Is there a lot of
not
very
much
valuable property around like that?
Not too much, but there is a fair bit of
money.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's plenty more if someone else wants to do this.
Yeah.
Thinking about this book was in near perfect condition when we got it. Two big sheets with 800 millimeters square. And it's been very well stored since 1752. So, normally in digital heritage, and they're applying with processing techniques to old parchments, they're quite badly degraded. And the problem usually is to try to read the writing on them or to find out something about the techniques that you're using. You're trying to reconstruct something from the degraded object. And generally, when you're doing that, you're making assumptions or guesses about what the original would have looked like. In this case, we know what the original was. We have the ground truth there, and we think about that, and also images of the undegraded pieces of stuff. Then we applied all these different treatments to simulate what happens in real life and things go wrong. and then we image them again. So now anyone who's taking up these images, you know, develop algorithms for reconstruction or replication, has the ground truth as well, so they can see how effective their algorithms really are. That's what makes the project really interesting.
Which usually goes first, deterioration in the ink or the actual
material? It would depend on many factors. Sometimes the ink, if it wasn't prepared very well, then the ink is actually what causes damage, so you will end up with your perfect document with holes where the ink was. Yeah, exactly, literally. On the other hand, because parchment reacts very readily to changes in humidity and temperature, normally you end up with the actual medium being very degraded, and then the ink still there visible, but on the very fragile substance.
As a part of this project, have to do the work of reconstructing the flat surface of a device that's not flat anymore. Mm-hmm. I noticed the voluntary parts of damage is not rather crumpled anymore, so I mean, nothing to do.
Well, so the one that actually was more the problem was the heat, because when parchment is heated up, as it shrinks down, it will turn up to curl up and end up in the ball, or really wavy. And because we didn't want to put too much variation to the image, we actually burned it, like heated that under the strong weight, so that the only variation was from the shrinking of the dimension, but it wasn't all coming up. And then for the scrunching up and the mechanical damage, all of that, although if you take it out from the where we store it, it's all like curled up. You can put it under, put everything in like under the glass. So under the glass, it will be flat.
Yeah, I mean, we're focusing on degradation techniques that affect the function in a way that is going to be good, but that can be solved through the technology.
It was used a lot from the 3rd century of the Common Era onward to replace papyrus, mostly because papyrus became very difficult to find in the Roman Empire, and also because around that era is when the books started to be put into codex. So you have wires folded up to make up your codex, as opposed to your scrolls. And when you have scrolls, papyrus works very well. When you try to make wires, it will break at the fold, and you end up with all single leaves. It doesn't work mechanically, so that's when fashion became even more important. And from that, it was used also in the Middle Ages. And in the
1200 is when paper starts to be produced in Italy and then spread it over around Europe.
One of the
first canons
was one of the eldest manuscripts or codices in touch are actually Tessamani documents which are exactly in the title. And they date to the 4th century. That's very much with the translation piece of the letters that they don't have the other ones.
Are there any other questions for the speakers? I'm sure we do. Thanks very much again.